Welcome to Backlog Dialogues, the podcast that digs you out of your backlog before it buries you. I'm John. Joining me as always are the Asahina Samidare and Noi Crescent to my Amamiya Yuhi.
You really gave yourself a higher challenge to that one, didn't you?
I guess I did. I decided I needed to say the whole names this time.
So you could have said Sami, Noi, and Yuhi, but you had to really push it.
Anyway, I'm Matt.
And I'm Jared.
So for our fourth mini-log, we are covering the cult classic manga from Satoshi Mizukami, Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer.
And I would say, unlike Gurren Lagann, this one is actually a cult classic in the true definition, where it's not all that well-known, but beloved among the people who know about it.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Like, Gurren Lagann has in recent years, like, just had a surge in popularity. It's all one of the big names of the aughts in terms of anime nowadays. Whereas Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer, which is almost a contemporary, we won't talk too much about the recent anime adaptation because none of us have watched it because we don't want to.
A series that in many recent polls got most disappointed, series most people started didn't finish, and
yeah,
is that it's what happens when you're very disrespectful and low budget to something.
Yes, but so we're talking about the manga. I can kind of understand people like wanting to watch anime but not wanting to read manga just because how they choose to spend their time and all that. But I remember reading the first chapter of this manga a long time ago, putting it down because I didn't quite get into it and feel like I was a bit weirded out by the tone. But I came back to it later when it was all finished and starting to get released in the West, and I just fell in love with it after a big binge read. It was like one of my favorite manga ever.
Yeah. So this is a work by Satoshi Mizukami. He's kind of just this artist who I swear has the worst luck with adaptations. Like, he's mostly only had one or two adaptations of his work, including one anime first manga. And while he is a fascinatingly unique, theme rich writer, it's like his stuff just doesn't get really penetrate when it should.
My introduction to Satoshi Mizukami was the anime of Planet With, which I quite enjoyed.
That being the series that was anime first, and then he kind of produced the manga alongside it.
Yeah, he basically with Planet With, he released the first chapter of the manga right around the same time as the anime started airing. I haven't followed up with reading more of the manga because I tend to avoid pirate sites nowadays. Did it ever get a Western release? I don't remember.
I think it was on Crunchyroll manga, but that's always really unreliable and they remove stuff all the time.
Mizukami's basic storytelling strategy is he takes a well-worn trope or storytelling theme in manga,
particularly shonen style. He loves going from the shonen angle of things.
Then he adds a thematic conflict to that as a twist. Sort of like getting into that, let's talk about why you should care about Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer. We're not covering the anime. The anime was fairly poorly adapted, so it's not going to be... I don't think it's worth your time. I think the biggest problem, though, is just like the animation does not follow the basic rules of animation. It's very stiffly drawn and not particularly interesting to look at, which is a shame because there's a lot of implied movement in the manga that is quite breathtaking when just like when your brain fills in all the details.
There's a lot of really good spreads in the manga, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of really good playing with the panels.
Mizukami is very good at, well, he's not like, say, the same level of insane artist as, say, the stuff you'll see in Berserk or a few other manga artists I can mention do. He has a really good sense of making strange, fantastical imagery just look really great in big images.
Mm-hmm.
Like Planet With was, like, I'll just switch over that quickly, had very strange, bizarre monsters, and they just kind of had this fascinating look to them, so...
Yeah.
And he definitely likes mecha or similar things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the thing that makes Mizukami interesting is, we kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, is that he likes to take media tropes and take them to their logical conclusion and then spin a story around them that is really strangely heartfelt despite being playing with all of these kind of goofy tropes.
Yeah. He has a lot of one shots I've read. I admit I use pirate sites for it, okay. But there's really other places. And there's one that called Wandering the Void that sticks with me, where he took the idea of like the space opera mission into the hero to save the planet. It kind of turned into this very elegiac, sad dissertation on what it is to be walking through the void of space and what you might find yourself if you have one purpose in like a generational voyage.
Wow.
It starts with a realization of like ants that are clearly a simulation. Like they're always walking in one hole. It's like, are we the same as those? Just walking our path.
With all that said, why specifically should you care about Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer?
Let's start with the pitch.
Yeah, let's start with the pitch. So stop me if you've heard this one. The world is in danger, and only a group of talented individuals selected by destiny can save it.
It's a group of knights with some sort of strange animal theming for them, so...
I know you've heard this kind of thing a million times before. Sit back down. Here's the twist. Two of the protagonists only want to save the world so they can destroy it themselves.
You can't fire me, I quit.
Yes. It kind of does remind me of Planet With, because the hook for that one as well is that we see this team of tokusatsu style
mecha fighters
with mech pilots and stuff like that.
Do we want to talk about the first episode twist of that one? Just cutting in to ask, are we going to be saying it's just what is?
We can say that as a comparison, but we all don't want to spend too much time talking about it.
Yeah, I was just saying that the way Planet With Hook Me is quite similar in that, you know, they had the tokusatsu team
fighting a giant monster.
And then we have a random guy who is visited by a strange mascot animal.
Well, who lives with a strange mascot animal. So he's been living with it for some years.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden he is told that he needs to go defeat these hero mecha pilots.
Yes.
Yeah. He's there to be the kid in the to be the strange rival in the mask who's there to defeat them and take away their powers.
Yes.
And we do see briefly, well, we don't see from his viewpoint, he sees a reason that he definitely wants to do that. I think I may be the one who's read the most different Mizukami stories. I read a lot of his less common stuff. He really likes twisting things from what would be traditionally antagonist position. Sengoku Yoku, another series of his, we start with two characters trying to forsake humanity, and then we switch to literally halfway through, the protagonist switches to a tyke bomb made by the villain group. I don't want to say too much about Spirit Circle, but let's say...
Yeah, we're not going to talk about Spirit Circle here, because Spirit Circle we're going to talk about in another mini-log somewhere down the line. That's my favorite manga ever. With all that in mind, all that context in mind, this is the intro act to Lucifer and the Biscuit Hammer. So Amamiya Yuhi is an antisocial college student who wakes up one morning to see a lizard right in front of him.
Just sitting on his chest while he's sleeping. The lizard stares right at him and says, "I need your help to save the world."
There's no preamble whatsoever.
Yeah.
"You have been selected to save the world." And he throws the lizard out the window.
Yeah. It might be the fastest call to adventure, reject the call in manga history. First page.
It goes on for quite a bit. The lizard's kind of a clingy thing. It just reappears easily.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the cat came back trope.
Yeah. The cat came back. But at this time, it is a lizard that calls himself Noi Crescent, the lizard knight. And he's in service of the princess in a war with a mage. Every single trope you've ever heard.
"We must help the princess save the world." Yuhi's like, "I don't care about the world. So you're stuck sitting on the sideline, chump."
He
actually kind of smirks at him after, as I recall. He
laughs
in the lizard's face for. He's definitely a very cynical guy. One of the first things we see him do is, as he's walking down the street, wind blows up someone's dress. And he's like, "Did you see that?" And he just gives her a thumbs up so he gets hit for it.
Yep. Yes. There's also, I would say that our protagonist, Yuhi, he's very nihilistic. We see a lot of stuff about his problems as we go. He kind of hates the world in a lot of ways for reasons because his upbringing was so fucked up.
Yeah.
We'll say, like, we see right away, he doesn't really care about anything. He's very passive, very much a loner. If he thinks about sticking his neck out, he imagines chains holding him down. Like it just like a voice telling him, don't risk things. Don't help people. Don't like make connections. So we tell there's trauma there, but still it's kind of led to this very dark view.
Back to the intro act. The lizard, I'll just start calling him Noi. Noi gives Yuhi a ring that enables a simple telepathic power to move things around with a little field. It's pretty basic.
It's like a little mouse cursor in the shape of a blob that you sort of move around from and grab things with. Mm-hmm. It's not very strong.
It's the, what you call it, the second player that collects star bits on Mario Galaxy.
That's another good pull. I like that.
Except he, of course, is controlling it. Yeah. And so naturally, like, he's still ignoring the lizard, and then suddenly he has a mental image of a knife stabbing him, and then there's a blob monster from him.
Is it the knight stabbing him, or is it a knife, like, stabbing the...
The original one is so small, is that he just imagines a knife hitting him. I'm almost certain.
Right, okay, yeah, it's the later ones that look like it's just, like, knives all over the place. But the manga visualizes this kind of, like, spiritual pressure that you would normally get in a shonen manga as just, like, a knife stabbing something.
He literally describes it as a killing instinct, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
The intent to kill. It's
he and the wizard argue on the street, and the wizard's like, it's bad, the enemy comes, and then he imagines a sword stabbing through him from behind, like he imagines the blood and everything.
Yep.
The wizard says, like, we can't win, we need to run.
Well, what they see is a weird one-eyed monster that Noi describes as a golem in the service of the mage.
It's very undifferentiated, kind of clay looking. Its head is pointy with one eye and a mouth sitting at the side, and its limbs end in blades. So it just... So it looks very derpy, but then it just flashes in front of him in an instant and is about to kill him.
Yep, it's super strong. Yuhi is the only person that can see it. The main characters being the only people that can see these kind of monsters. Another common trope of this kind of thing. Basically, everything you would expect to see in this kind of story, except for the fact that the main character doesn't give a shit about it, even when he's being attacked by it.
Yeah.
Yes.
It says, so far, our main character has used his power to flip a skirt and has told that he doesn't care about anything. And now he's like saying he's like he's just about to die. And then the cheerful high school girl from next door just pops in front of him and obliterates it with a punch.
Yeah. The girl, his next door neighbor, and also the sister of his teacher in college, Asahina Samidare.
And of course, he notes that he sees her panties when she hits it because he's kind of a bit warped.
He is very warped.
And I admit Mizukami kind of likes that sense of humor. It can be a little annoying at times, but he's just kind of very chipper about it. He's, and almost so brazen about it doesn't matter.
He's better about it in Spirit Circle, I'd say.
No, don't forget him playing it with the repeated figurine jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He also learns that if he participates in this big story, Noi will grant him one wish.
And like the lizard's complaining to her that he doesn't want to help, but she doesn't care that much. Though she just smack him in the head with her foot for talking about her panties because, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So the next day, Samidare shows him the biscuit hammer up in the sky and nobody else notices it at all. Yeah. And he never noticed it in his life before it was pointed out to him.
Yeah. Talking about great spreads. We just have the shot of the two of them on like a school roof. Like you see them and we see the railing far down and kind of this fisheye angle of the sky. There's this gigantic, simple silhouette of, like I said, basically a large blocky hammer that's up in the sky.
Basically like a toy hammer is the best way to put it. It is a giant toy hammer floating in space that is going to destroy the planet.
It's the wizard's ultimate creation.
It's called the biscuit hammer because apparently it's going to destroy the Earth like a biscuit? Question mark.
Oh, that's what that translation says, because the Crunchyroll says that it smashes planets like crackers. Like, okay.
Yeah.
We'll talk about where the name actually comes from, but so Samidare takes a little jump off the roof to test Yuhi's loyalty and abilities.
And he's able to catch her like as you're on the roof and uses his field to slow himself down. We saw him practicing it barely, but it's a tough trick, but he just barely manages it.
She declares that they will destroy the hammer because the only thing that will destroy the world is her fist. You see something flip in Yuhi's brain at this moment.
He goes from shocked and hollow-eyed to hollow-eyed with a weird grin. And then we switch to the shot of her with the hammer in the sky behind the clouds flowing. She has this wicked grin. Her school uniform's flaring out like a cape. He's like, swear your fealty to me.
Yep. Yeah. And so
I kind of feel like the reason that this is because he has been kind of starved for somebody to trust him, to confide in him, because that has been the thing that he's had so much anxiety about for so long, that when somebody actually does it out of blue and tells him something like this, he just latches onto it right away.
Yeah, it's a big enough belief for him to truly get behind, and it also kind of like reflects his own twisted morality right now.
Is that he is, like I said, we really do see how damaged he is. It kind of resonates with that. The idea of doing something big and destructive just almost seems crazily appealing to him.
Yep. Yeah.
And so with that, the story of Smashing Planets begins.
The night of the night and the little Lucifer that he follows.
Yes.
So
yeah,
this is going to be a bit early for a spoiler section because we're doing this a bit differently this time. So at this point, if you have not read this manga, it is available on Crunchyroll in their manga section.
I think it might be leaving soon, so I'm hoping it's still up by the time we record.
The manga is currently out of print. Find some way to read it. I beseech you. It is life-changing.
Yes.
It was really good manga.
But we can't summarize it. As I was saying, Mizukami is an incredibly dense writer. He puts incredible amounts of story in relatively short amounts without them just being dialogue dumps either. Like, he layers multiple concepts.
Yes.
And some of them you won't realize till much later, and you realize, oh, that's what it was showing. So just trying to describe it on its own is actually kind of self-defeating.
So
yeah,
we're going to go into the spoiler section now. I hope if you listen on the other end, you will have enough context to be able to follow what we have to say. Because we're just going to discuss the entire damn work behind the spoiler section, starting now.
Warning. Spoiler alert.
Warning.
Spoiler alert.
Warning.
Spoiler alert.
As we said before the spoiler section kicked in, we can't summarize the series. The big Gurren Lagann minilog, which was fun to record, it was still took way too long to record and edit, and something was just lost by summarizing it. So we're going to try to take a very hard book club approach to ask questions and discuss the themes of this story. Let's get right into it.
We've got plenty to say about the characters, about some of the things that happen, but there's so many things that happen in so many ways
that it's hard to just, like, you can't put it in order. You have to, like, talk about it as a holistic work.
It's so difficult simply because of the fact that Mizukami is really good at just layering different things at the same time, because at the same time one thing is happening, he's also advancing this other subplot and invoking this other theme. And so you can't even just really go chapter by chapter and say, this is what happened in here.
I mean, he's never met a story, a theme where he didn't like so much that he didn't want to stack three or four more on top of it to see what happens.
Yeah. So the core theme of this story is growing up.
Yeah, it's a coming of age story.
Yeah. It is a coming of age story, but it's also kind of like it assumes the idea that it's not just children that come of age. Anyone at any point in their life can grow up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And every single night is at a stage in their life where they need to do some growing.
I mean, just Yuhi's really college students. And do we want to go a little bit more into his story? Do you want to, like, wait for a bit on that?
Let's wait a bit on that.
Yeah. He'll act be like a jaded adult or a whiny kid, depending on basic random moments.
The thing that I liked about Yuhi is that I saw a bunch of myself in him, because he very much seemed like a, you know, a smart, talented kid, but he was searching for meaning. He didn't have any meaning in his life because he was unable to form personal connections in his life.
I don't know if it's so much a search for meaning, but it's finding a way to love the world is one of the most core parts of growing up in this story.
And yeah. It's like a lot of characters, they need to search for hope because the future is scary.
Yeah.
A lot of people are in, like, I don't know how I describe myself, but a lot of people, both in story and out, they find themselves in a place where it feels like everything's dark and everything stays dark.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of what the story says, is that's never necessarily the choice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a sub theme of forgiveness as a part of that, and how it treats the idea of forgiveness.
Yeah, I mean, they talk, there's a lot of themes about every character has made mistakes, even adults.
Yeah. And
especially adults.
Yeah. Yes.
It's all a matter of, like, what is perceived as adults. Like, teenagers will see people in their 20s as adults. People in their 20s will see people who are approaching middle age or older as adults. Little children may see just someone who's just, like, 2 years older than them as an adult still. These are all truths.
There was one point where the author really dropped the anvil kind of mid to late in the story, where Yuhi is finally kind of coming into himself a little bit. And he explicitly says that, you know, I don't feel like I'm an adult yet, but I know that the younger people in our group see me as the adult, as the role model. So I need to do something better for their sake.
Well, and there's a very specific reason why he does that. It's because before a lot of the group is introduced, one certain event happens that we'll talk about when we get into the character things. But the core of that is someone comes along to be a mentor and tells him to smile like being an adult is fun, which I think is, like, a line that sticks with me from this series for all time. It's amazing.
And it's not even saying be happy or don't be sad. It's like, try to see. It's a way of saying, and almost a a character who kind of speaks in very simple ways, like find the fun in it and then smile like you can. And you maybe yeah. you'll find that helps.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's not just about you. It's about all the people that are going to follow after you.
Yeah.
So there's another primary theme in this story, which is the clash of ideologies.
Yeah, I think Mizukami has a pattern of characters aren't really trying to deceive you or intentionally misdirect you when they talk. They are simply professing their ideology completely seriously. You know what I mean?
Yes. Like, characters actually very rarely lie. Like, in this one, the only thing we see is that Yuhi and Sami never tell the others what they're planning.
Yeah, they lie by omission, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead, there's a clash of ideologies that's inherent in the main conflict, and it explores that conflict. And even on lower levels, there are sub-clashes of different ideologies, like, you know, the way that our protagonist Yuhi kind of does his growing up is by having his nihilistic ideology clash with the realities of all the other people around him that he's found himself in the situation with.
Mm-hmm. So I think at this point we talk about the characters, and I think we're this point spoilers are now completely off the chings, or are we talking about their specific issues?
Sure. Mm-hmm. So let's get right into the main character, Amamiya Yuhi, the Lizard Knight, and his little iguana buddy, Noi Crescent.
I'm going to say early, a lot of the animals don't get strong characterization. Noi might be one of the, just by lieu of screen time, he gets the most. He's very snarky, kind of dour. We see he has low self-esteem because the lizard tends to keep failing. Oh, a spoiler that we hear in early, these fights have been going back in time over and over.
We do need to say that about the general premise of this. This battle has been continually happening in the future.
And like crawling backwards through time.
It's kind of weird because it's not spelled out for a long time, but we keep getting little hints of the various animals saying, implying that things have happened before and giving warnings from those previous times.
And one of the first is Noi thinking, will I be dropping out first again? So we know that we learned that the animals have habits of who they pick, which makes you wonder about Noi, but Yuhi, he's kind of a ball of abused pain, unfortunately.
Yeah.
His parents died young. I believe they were connected with the police, much like their grandfather. And since they died, and I think they were betrayed by someone, the grandfather, in incredibly misplaced grief and pain, basically started chaining Yuhi to his room. Like, and telling him how you can't trust people. You can't, like, don't try to reach out to people. It's too dangerous.
Like, he seemed to have been literally chained up. Like, whenever he would try to make a friend, his grandfather would crack down on it.
And like I said, and you see it's based on pain and misery, but he's still taking it out on a young boy for much of his life.
So the line from the manga that, like, sticks with me. Day after day after day after day, I reminded you. Make no enemies. They will stab you in the gut. Make no friends. They will stab you in the back. People are nothing but trash, and that includes us. Don't love anyone or let them love you.
A couple chapters later, he explains how his father's partner was a smuggler as a detective and killed him. He said, whenever I disagreed with my grandfather, he'd cover me in chains and locked me in a closet. He raised me to be a loner.
Yeah. And so, like, that philosophy is at the core of Yuhi's pain.
Yeah.
He literally envisions the chains holding him down when he starts to believe in something or wants to push himself.
He has a huge crisis of confidence that when he tries to push himself to become a more reliable person for Samidare, he basically, the chains literally appear in the panel around him and stop him from doing what he wants to do.
A speech I heard three times every day. That makes 10,956 times in 10 years.
The sheer amount of pain in Yuhi's heart is palpable. But then the story decides to say, this little shit who doesn't believe in anything has got to be our protagonist, which means he's got to change.
I feel like a lot of it as well is that the reason that he was so compelled by Samidare's idea was because of the fact that he essentially had very little to live for. It felt like until this hit, he was going through the motions in life. He was smart, so he ended up doing well in school and went to college because that's what's expected of somebody like him, more or less.
Yeah.
He didn't really have any of his own motivation and ambition.
Like, I would say his path is first Samidari first breaks the chains, literally like in a dream sequence. And then he starts like reaching out to others, learns what being adult can be like, learns what it is to be with others.
Yeah. So let's talk about all the other people that change him through their interactions with him.
Because we got to get a little bit more precise quickly on this.
Yeah, we got to go through a lot of characters here. It's a pretty hefty manga. There's 12 of these knights, and then there's other characters outside of them.
And every character that has important elements to share.
Every character is, like, extremely well fleshed out, and you, like, get who they are by the end of it.
The Site Anime News Network once said it's like getting a whole stack of shonen protagonists dumped on your house to take care of you. Good luck.
Yep. Anyway,
always a favorite joke of mine.
Naturally, of course, the first one we got to talk about is Asahina Samidare, the princess,
aka Lucifer,
or the little Lucifer. Yes,
her role is that she is connected to and or possessed by one of the two beings that are part of this whole war, this game.
Yes.
Yeah. For a long time, we kind of get a confusion of whether she is Princess Anima or whether Princess Anima is attached to her. Later on in the series, that becomes more clear, but we don't actually get that completely cleared up for a while, I don't think.
So she is the strongest of all the characters just by sheer physical power.
Yeah, like she is literally just a high powered paragon. She has physical stats through the roof. Nothing seems to hurt her. She can pick up a car casually and throw it. We see her do that in like the second fight, and she only gets stronger as time goes on.
Yeah.
However, all that strength is borrowed because she is on borrowed time.
It's a little vague that if it's just a prince power or if it's a power she could have had that's being unlocked. But yes, she is not someone who should be this strong and let's say hardy.
We find out later in the series that essentially she was terminally ill and very sickly for all of her life. And then when this whole mess started and the run up to this secret war against the mage began, the power that was unlocked with the coming of Princess Anima made her a superhuman. But as soon as the war is over in some way, she is going to go back to being terminally ill and die.
Yes.
It's something that she's lived with her whole life. They actually are very vague as to what is, what synthesis is, but it seems like she often has attacks or weakened. She spent much of her life in the hospital up to now. Mm-hmm. She's described as her life has been so up in the air that made her a being without wants because she didn't know she'd live another day.
And so when she was shown the Earth from space, she asked if she could have that. And she wants no one else to have the world. And so by destroying the world, she will claim it for herself.
Yeah. Even though he doesn't remember because of her actions, she met Yuhi as a young boy when she was very little too. So she has this built-in memory of him that he doesn't have, so she wants to keep him close as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's not really malicious or cruel or controlling. No. She just wants him to. Like, she promised, like, I'll destroy the things you want me to destroy if you want something you, like, lead to. She asks him at more than one point if he loves the world, and he's like, yes, but I still want to do what you say, and she just sort of accepts it, but he thinks, like, she's thinking.
I just want to discuss a little bit about, I think it's interesting that they do call her Lucifer in this simply because of the parallel to the kind of occultist idea of Lucifer as a liberator figure, kind of a Promethean figure, but he does it through destruction of the old order. So that's kind of what Samidare represents to Yuhi at the beginning.
But it's also important to just point out like how she connects to the theme of growing up, because in her perspective, she is unable to grow up.
Yes, she is a permanent child.
Mm-hmm. And so that is kind of like the thing that is driving her desires as well.
Even though she was one who didn't worry about desire, the more she's too kind to not become attached to everyone. But the more she does, the more she realizes she'll be left behind. That's made very clear in a long discussion late in it. The more she becomes attached to everyone, the more things get
broken. We'll probably discuss the ending of her character arc in more detail later at the end.
Yep. I think so. Let's try and do about like less than 5 minutes per character right now, because there's a lot of these things. The next character, I would argue the most important side character in the early part and maybe even the entire series, is Shinonome Hangetsu, the Dog Knight.
the second knight to appear. He appears in the middle of a fight, just crashes in out of nowhere to take up the fight there. And immediately, because he's a boisterous, bold, self-proclaimed hero of justice, immediately gives Yuhi a inferiority complex.
Yeah.
Yeah. He is like basically a talented martial arts master. He operates on pure talent rather than anything else.
And he's also naturally charismatic.
Yeah, he's unbeatable hand to hand. He fights. He apparently does fight jobs for occasionally shady organizations, but mostly just to clean up streets and that. And he describes himself as someone who once wanted to be a hero of justice.
And Yuhi comes to look up to him as what he wants to and needs to be if he's going to help Samidare.
But at the same time, because he's so so early, he has such a hard time with his reaction stuff. He concludes that he's a threat that he needs to get rid of, too. But
yes.
Yeah.
It's a similar kind of dynamic to what we saw with Simon and Kamina and Gurren Lagann, in terms of just like he's kind of the big brother character to Yuhi. But there's also that dark twist to it, the threat to the greater plan. Yes.
His ally is the dog Ludo Shubari, who he insists by calling by
Noku.
And we find out it's part of his whole I can't be a hero of justice, because when he was young, his actions caused his dog to get killed. I think it was literally pushing him out of the way of a car or something. Kind of forced Hangetsu to kind of conclude that people can't just be heroes. So kind of it didn't break him, but it definitely made him much sadder, much more contemplative about what it means.
But that's also why he delivers the philosophy of smile like being an adult is fun.
Yes. Yeah,
because he knows being an adult isn't fun, but you got to give people something to look up to and something to look forward to.
And so the kind of ending of his character arc is that during one of the fights with the golem, he ends up in the heat of the moment, sacrificing himself for the others.
Yeah, like a ball covered in fists. Just I can't remember if he gets in the way of Yuhi. He just takes a hit to the midsection. And from that point, he's definitely doomed.
Yeah,
it literally is that serious a fight.
And we find out that he never used his wish until the very end. And nobody knows what his wish actually was. And we don't find out until the next day when Yuhi is training that his final wish was to give all of his talent to Yuhi.
Yeah, I'd argue it's actually much later, not till he fights the next golem.
Yeah, yeah.
Once that's over, the first act is over, and we suddenly have an influx of characters.
Yeah, a lot of characters are introduced all at once. The first one we're introduced to is Shinonome Mikazuki, Hangetsu's younger brother.
Who he had mentioned briefly and said that he was a bit of a crazy fighter. And believe me, that is the case. Mikazuki is the embodiment of fight me, bro.
Yes. Yeah.
He's the embodiment of come at me, bro. There you go.
Yeah. He is the Crow Knight. His animal familiar, or whatever you want to call him, is Mu. As in the concept of nothingness.
Mu never speaks.
Yeah.
Mikazuki, he's not evil, but he's a crazy fight fanatic who will literally get in the way of the action scenes because he wants to fight the people he thinks are strong. Like, he actually is a detriment.
He's basically Goku, but as not the protagonist.
Yeah, he's a shonen rival, but also Goku. Maybe a Vegeta?
And for some reason, he has a mouthful of pointy teeth.
Yeah, well,
yes.
Lots of people in this series have very pointy teeth.
Yeah, but we're talking literally zigzag, jaggy teeth like he's a shark.
Yeah. Mikazuki had a very large inferiority complex towards his brother.
Yeah.
And basically that kind of transfers on to Yuhi as soon as Mikazuki figures out what's going on.
Like, he doesn't think it as, like, it's negative, but he really saw it as, well, I want to kill my brother because he's stronger, but if your fate swallowed my brother's fate, that means that if I kill you, that means I'm stronger.
Yeah,
so I don't know if inferiority is the right word. It's, like, insane competitiveness.
Yeah, but I do like that one line, though. I thought that was a really good line from Mikazuki, just kind of showing how twisted he is that, you know, like, you might not be as strong as him, but your fate is so strong that you swallowed him whole.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
And like, wow, that's actually a really interesting way to put it. Like, that's it's hard to even argue against that.
Yeah. And just to make the rival thing more ridiculous, he falls in love with Sabadari almost immediately.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
After she knocks him to the ground for attacking Yui, of course.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely the type of shonen protagonist, a person who bonds with people by fighting them.
The funny thing is, he's also popular, has his own weird charisma, and like people who like he just kind of gets along in the world more than Yui. So he has this kind of ridiculous tone.
Like Yui even goes along with him on a job one day,
which is literally just standing outside a mafia room to make sure nothing happens.
Yeah, you know, he's a bouncer.
He's more of a mercenary for hire, but he's also just this weirdly positive creature. Like if he's not in fights, he's always smiling. He literally is happy. And he doesn't worry about action. See, like when he was told he had a wish, he sees a kid looking hungry nearby. He says, give that kid a piece of bread.
He's very strangely good natured.
Yeah.
In a ridiculously short sighted dope sort of way. But that's you can't hate that, you know?
No. Yeah. He's great because he rules.
But then now we have to get even weirder by having even weirder animals show up. And so here's a horse.
Nagao Shoichiro, the horse knight. The horse's name is Dance Dark, and no one is allowed to ride him.
Yes. Well, no, men are not allowed to ride him.
Good point.
Yeah. Yes.
He also tends to try to eat people's hair every so often. So this guy just has this invisible, to most normals, full-size horse following him around.
Yes.
He's just kind of this gruffy guy in his rough late 30s or okay mid
30s. Yeah, he's a former detective, or is he an actual detective still?
He's former. He we find out later. He says to a dramatic lightning strike, I said, are you worried about your job? It's okay.
I'm unemployed.
Yes.
What a great line.
About the same time, he kind of, when somebody asks him what his wish was, he flippantly says, I used it to win the lottery.
Yep.
No. Matt, you're completely wrong. We don't find that out to the very last chapter.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that he mentioned it. And nobody believed what it was.
I think he just says vaguely his wish took care of it, and they all speculate about it.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay, and yeah. At the end, they mention, like, I thought it was funny that he really did use his wish to win the lottery.
And then they finally just kind of financed them messing around for months on this.
Yep.
So Nagumo wants to be the adult in the brain cell in the room. He's pretty serious. He's jaded, but not completely cynical. And he tries to be the driving force, saying we need to get together. We need to solve the mission.
Yeah, he really tries to be the adult in the room. And I guess a lot of that is coming from the whole trying to be an ex-cop and being responsible for what's going on.
That was story briefly. He stopped being a cop when he was forced to let go like a son of someone important from some mid-level petty crimes. Then he punched a kid in front of the dad who's like, okay, that's fine too. It just, he felt completely useless for it. So just feel like I'm not doing anything. So
he also knows a lot of really interesting people.
Oh yeah. I just like him and his partner. Like we see his flashback. He quits because I was like, and we see Dan Stark just running next to the car. He's like, so how fast do you think horses can run? They're so fast. He's very poker faced.
Yep. Yes.
He really works on he's the serious face guy that weird things happen to every so often.
Let's see. He has a fortune teller friend, I think it is. Someone who can literally see the future.
His ex-police partner, she has visions and like draws pictures from sometimes. He knows this weird bum who's also a martial, like a sword master.
Yeah.
And our next character knows that bum sword master too and gets all of her talent from him.
Hakudo Yayoi.
A woman in her mid-20s, probably a couple years out of college, very traditionally pretty, long white hair, and carries a sword everywhere.
She's also a cosplayer.
Yeah, she's a closet otaku.
Oh, yeah. She really tries to play up the elegant beauty because certain characters can teleport you out of nowhere, and she's often found wearing costumes. She suffers horribly for that.
Yeah, she's a huge nerd that's behind it all.
She hangs out with the snake.
Shay Moon.
And she also kind of, in the later series, as Yuhi gets a lot more adult and reliable, she kind of develops a bit of a crush on him.
Not just a crush. It is a... Yeah.
Full blown.
It is full blown, out in the open. She loves Yuhi, and she also is the first one that learns that Yuhi and Sabidari are planning something.
Yes.
And she even says, like, I love you, you should go out with me. Also, you shouldn't destroy the world. It's like, well, that's a completely different issue we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. Kind of, like, she's being kind of calm about it, she doesn't really push it. it's almost not worth mentioning. Like, we could go through so many things, like everyone's different powers in that. Yeah. I just kind of mentioned hers because she just takes her sword and puts it at the end of a long whip extension, like it's a, like a snake tail. I just want to mention that one because it's one of the more creatively weird ones.
Yeah, it's a, something that comes up a lot visually because it looks really cool in fights.
Her wishes, she wishes that everyone in her family, when they die, will die smiling. And the snake's like, well, I guess that's okay. It's she but, sort of just sees that she doesn't want people to die. She just like, wants to assure that everyone she knows will not die suffering. And she says it with a very weird, flat smile on her face. It's one of those moments that really sticks out.
Next up is Kusakabe Taro, the Mouse Knight.
And Sorano Hanako, the Mantis Knight, because these two are a pair.
They are introduced at the exact same time, riding on a bicycle.
Like, all the knights are coming together. He literally thinks to himself, I don't think we can find knights that quickly. And he sees, like, a pair of high school students drive by with a talking mouse and mantis on it. It's like, huh.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It's one of the best little gags.
Yeah, these ones, they're very literal childhood friends. It's a trope, like, when they look outside the bedroom, the other ones is across the next house over, so they talk outside. Taro is kind of mild mannered. He's a little bit wimpy. He likes to cook. And Hanako is very kind of goes her own pace. I don't know how else to describe it. She's very calm, very unwarped. She was excited to have this talking bug to show her friend.
Taro is the guy who had the ambition to become a chef, right?
Yeah. And he is so blatantly in love with Hanako, and she doesn't particularly seem to notice. But he's got the too wimpy to say anything mode.
I love the name of their animal friends they have too.
Lance Lumiere the mouse.
And Killzone the mantis.
Yeah.
Yep. Very strange.
This one, we're going to go to the spoilers here because we're talking about the wishes.
Well, we're in the spoiler section. All spoilers are on the table.
Hanako impulsively death notes a guy on the news. He's like, that guy's a killer. Can we kill him? And he's like, and the mantis says, sure. And which infuriates the mouse, who thinks the mantis is kind of a shady asshole who picks people to manipulate. Because apparently, if you wish to kill someone, it kind of reflects their karma on you, and you're more likely to die horribly. So Taro saves his wish, and later on, he takes a blow for her that stabs you both of them, and he uses his wish to save her before he dies. And he's the second to die of the knights.
Yep.
Yeah.
Then she tries to flush the mantis down the toilet, which doesn't go so well.
Nope.
The next character is one I actually really like. I like Shimaki Hyo, the cat knight.
He imagines he must be this really sleek, really elegant looking guy. It's just this big round guy. He looks like me.
Yeah, he's a slightly older college student.
Yeah. Well, right? I think he's like an adult in his mid-20s or early 30s.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 He's got this kind of mop of black hair, glasses. He's big and round. He maybe makes you think of myself if I was translated to a slightly Japanese style.
He comes off as an intellectual type, and his power kind of complements that.
Yeah.
He's one of the few who's, once again, their power's worth mentioning because it has a major element.
He asks for the power to make golems, much in the way that the mage can.
And he does. Like, he makes golems that go through the cycles of one eye and forward. The golems are marked by the number of eyes they have. The mage's golems are named after an obscure calendar. I don't really know.
It's the Greek month, Greek calendar.
That's it. Yeah. So they have very strange names. I'm not going to try to push.
Shimaki goes with days of the week.
In German. Sonntag, Montag.
Mm-hmm. And for the most part, they kind of are like, much weaker than the mage's golems, but they still have their uses.
And there's a decent understanding that it's experience. He's still trying to figure out how this works. So
yeah.
He kind of makes wasteful ones that are too easy to destroy. And he's also several back in the step from it.
Yeah, he also makes a few golems specifically to help the others train against golems.
He literally will make them with harmless weapons and a deadly weapon, like with fists and a spike, things like that, to kind of make it work there.
Mm-hmm.
At least once they accidentally break one. He's like, this is my new one. They just smash it. Whoops.
The next two are another pair.
Another pair that was once a trio.
Tsuchishiro Yukimachi, the turtle knight. Hoshikawa Subaru, the rooster knight. And their deceased master, Akitani Inachika, the swordfish knight.
I'm going to talk about the two first. So what we have here is a pair of girls, I believe younger than 10.
Yeah, they're the youngest in the party by far.
You got the pale-haired girl with pigtails who hangs out with the turtle. She kind of does the eyes shut, always kind of chill and easygoing. When she sees the turtle, she's super excited and grabs it. She wants to like say, look at this talking turtle I found. She puts it in a box.
The facial expression she has when we see her flashback of when she first sees the turtle is one of the best panels. It's amazing.
So yee, turtle!
Well, like, not just that, it's just like she's specifically excited about a talking turtle that she can put in a box.
I could sell this.
Yep.
And then Subaru is red, is kind of red hair, looks a bit more tomboyish, but she's actually kind of the more gentle natured, calm one of the two. They both wish for each the other one's happiness. So, yeah, yes. They're just a very close, goofy pair.
Yep. And they were being trained by Master Akitani Inachika, who...
Or just Master.
Yes, yeah. Who is a very strange figure. And I might also mention that the name is a palindrome in Japanese.
Yeah. Master is the coolest person. He did everything. In history. 800 years old. He learned everything. He has infinite power. You can see the future perfectly. And he wrote an amazing book about it. That
he literally knows everything that's going to happen to himself and to the world.
He is the Swordfish Knight. And with a gigantic 8-foot long swimming swordfish that we only get to meet for one chapter.
He's kind of interesting because, like, he's basically every trope of a, you know, like the itinerant bodhisattva in a lot of, you know, Japanese media.
Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is he literally wrote a book and buried it in a hole where he knew Yuhi would find it because Yuhi has taken up digging pits as training / planning.
Yeah, so his ability to predict the future even extends that far. He literally knew exactly where that Yuhi was going to start digging holes, and he would dig the hole right here.
Yeah. And here's my life story to tell you. It's like, and then I learned that I was immortal. And Yuhi's like, this book's getting good. Yeah. So he's 800 years old, and his power fades just as the animals appear, like he had been fading with his last apprentices, and he knew it was going to be his death. Mm-hmm. And he dies protecting the two from a golem that had apparently been skipped in the pattern that we hadn't seen. And then teaching them the final lesson of how to fight and to tell the mage that the message from is we are all human.
The two children there kind of have, like, they're not very physically capable, but they have a powerful team up attack where they can do either the ultimate spear or the ultimate shield, but only one at a time.
Yeah, basically they sync their powers together and use two people's power at once. It actually seems a little bit stronger than the sum of it. Like its whole is stronger than the sum of parts. It's emergence.
The two of them also end up attaching to Mikazuki. Like they end up hanging out with him a lot.
I was like, is this a kidnapping? You're kidnapping elementary school kids? No, I found knights.
and like, they're seen together constantly after that. It's kind of hilarious how, like, they're a really good trio.
This is Subaru has a clear crush on the 20-year-old, so that's not all worrying.
Nothing is reciprocated until the 10 years later ending. So
in a sort of vaguely maybe.
Yeah.
And the last night is the Owl Night. Now, something that we skipped is that back when Hangetsu died, the dog had one less special one. This was the Beware of the Owl. The Owl Loki Helios.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Akane Taiyo is a little bit distant at first.
Another young kid. I think he's actually the same age as the girls. I'm really not sure.
He looks older, but he's closer than age.
He's also very serious, very withdrawn.
He's another person that wants the destruction of the world, but he's on the side of the mage, technically, rather than on the side of the princess.
What we find out from later is that the last Owl Knight betrayed the Dog Knight and was the last one. But then we find out later the Owl Knight then attacked the mage and was killed for it.
Yeah.
Like, he's not a real traitor, but he puts on airs of being a traitor.
Listen, Akane is another kid. He's abused by severe neglect. His father married another woman after his mother died and just basically doesn't want anything to do with him, just gives him money to leave the house and just doesn't talk to him. Mm-hmm. So he's very much like family doesn't matter. And because of that, he's Loki. We find out he's tired of watching his partners die, so he's counseling that maybe it's easier to join the mage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he gets a lot of good characterization there where he finally reveals that, you know, hey, look, I really hate seeing my partners die, and he actually cries about it. It's really interesting. Yeah.
But he also says it's sad to think of a kid wishing for death. So it's like Akane gains healing powers, which is important. And while he spends time working with the mage, that at the end, he really just can't quite stomach it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He isn't truly so wishing for the end that he doesn't worry about others, that he isn't receptive to others reaching out to him. Like like Yuhi and Mikazuki having him hang out with them and watch stupid shit on TV.
Yep. So let's talk about the big picture stuff real quick. Let's talk about Animus and Anima.
Yep. Animus is the mage. So just get these names right. We got Animus is the mage. Anima is the princess. So just kind of remember that.
Well, Animus is the male spirit and Anima is the female spirit. So,
yeah.
Not all of us have followed that mythology. You know, I have a hard time remembering.
Well, us is the Latin masculine ending and A is the Latin feminine ending. So
I also didn't take Latin. You're really just going for specialist work here, buddy.
Okay. So
in any case,
anyway,
Animus is a kind of unkempt guy wandering around in pajamas. Looks like he's about 20 to 30, but he's very thin. His eyes are sunken. He just kind of has this flat, uninterested look on his face and is very casual and lazy.
He's kind of interesting. For a long time in the story, he kept trying to actually contact the various knights in order to try to get them on his side. It was kind of interesting.
I feel like I'm going to talk about their backstory a little bit later, but you get the impression he's just trying new things to see what's fun. He literally first makes an appearance, like there was a half-destroyed golem. He crawls out of its mouth and just kind of walks in the air saying, that was fun.
Yep.
I just want to say very quickly here that I love the way music kind of plays and things. He pops up for a little talk with Yuhi, who immediately tries to kill him. Like, fuck it. Like, he doesn't even pause. He swings his hand right at his face, like, trying to snap his neck so he gets teleported into the stratosphere for it.
Yep. Mm. Animus is essentially pretty much all powerful. Do we want to go into the backstory of the Animus and Anima after we talk about Anima a bit?
I'll say after we talk Anima, yeah. Animus can casually teleport people, doesn't seem to be affected normally. He creates golems, but does seem to have a bit of a wind-up for it, like it takes time to put together them together. And he seems to be locked into the rules of the conflict, but other than that, he just does whatever he feels like. So Anima is the princess, who we don't see for half the manga.
Yep. And then she suddenly shows up and is more or less just like a weird element that keeps being added.
Long-haired, curvy girl wearing a weird form-fitting outfit, which also has super long sleeves stick past her hand.
She's always eating.
Huge ring that floats around her head. It looks like a weird planetary model, I guess. And she barely talks. She's very antisocial.
I wouldn't say antisocial. She's intentionally weird, but she sticks around with a group pretty frequently.
Okay. Well, she sticks around Samatari's house because there's food.
True.
She also often basically is there to move the plot along when things start getting bogged down.
Well, when she there's this wonderful moment where she Noi was really happy to see her, but there's this wonderful moment where Montez, like, when all the Emma's here, that she turned, each of them let out a small sigh.
Yep.
The next thing she does is she just randomly teleports them all to a meeting place. One of the times poor Yayoi's cosplay gets made fun of. She goes right up to Dan Stark the horse, says you, and puts a horn on his head, and now he's a unicorn.
Yeah.
Because there's three upgraded knights.
There's Unicorn, Hraesfelgr, and Invisible are the three possible upgrades. And there's like this sort of dichotomy of these four animals can become Hraesfelgr, these four animals can become Unicorn, these four can become Invisible.
We're trying to figure out which ones could become a unicorn other than the horse. Like, imagine, like, the dog?
Yeah. Very strange.
It says Hraesfelgr is a bird. It's still tricky.
Yeah, basically all of these are, like, weird upgrades to the various knights. You become a mythical beast knight.
Yeah.
Which upgrades their power.
Yeah.
And only three characters would normally get one in the course of the story, but the final act of this whole war...
Things get weird.
Let's talk about where they come from real quick, and then we can talk about the golems as one last thing.
Yep.
So basically, Anima and Animus are from the far future. I don't even remember what year they say.
Like 6,000 years, I want to say? Something like that?
Maybe. But like wherever it is, there's casual space travel and colonies and other planetoids. Find out like they are the two survivors of a random wreck in which a space lighter just ruptured from inside.
They're basically being studied, as I recall.
Not exactly. They're in the hospital, and the two of them are talking. Like Animus said, how he just pushed against the wall to see what happened with his powers, and he caused the wreck.
Yeah.
Anima is like kind of more of a cheerful girl, saying we shouldn't do things like that. But then a doctor comes and says, like, well, you have amazing powers. I think we should study you, and you could be like gods. And Animus is like, he just gets the worst smile on his face from that.
Yeah. The reason Animus is more or less the villain of the story is because he has been given express permission never to grow up. by that one line.
Yep.
I mean, they look like they're about 10 or 11. And he then immediately, like, just from that, he already was wondering if his powers are special. Emma wasn't really buying into it. So he immediately wrecks the moon base they're on and then forms the biscuit hammer and smashes the earth while Emma tries to stop him,
yeah,
which opens a rift and pulls him back a undisclosed amount of time. He's like, oh, I can do it again.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, no, we shouldn't do it again. How about we do a game?
The only way she can stop him from, like, doing it instantly is by putting the system of rules in place, which is the entire war between the princess and the mage.
We hear a bit more conversation. He says, like, you keep changing the rules, but you're never going to win. Though for some reason, it's taking him longer to form the biscuit hammer each time. There's a lot of possibilities, but all he says, like, I don't know why it takes so long. Now it's a whole year.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they've been moving backwards through time. They notice they grew up physically, but they barely noticed this happened. It was very subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like she keeps trying to stop him. She thinks this is wrong, but he's won every time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He wants to go back. He thinks he'll just keep going back to what's the beginning of the universe to see what's there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what we have is two weird kids who have now been living for centuries.
Mm-hmm. And one has not been able to grow up and the other one does not want to.
Right.
Yep. The last important character that we probably want to talk about is, oddly enough, one of the golems, Mymacterion.
Most of the golems are completely mindless creatures, but one of them was just, he made as a shapeshifter with almost endless form change ability, and it has intellect.
Yeah, it is one of the most fascinating characters in the entire story because it is distinctly inhuman, despite looking like human.
But also completely self-aware of what it is.
Yeah, it is fascinated by humanity, but also does not accept humanity.
He takes the form of a small child and kind of forms a weird, not quite friendship with Tayo.
Yeah.
Like, basically, like, I like hanging out at you and your house. No one bothers me there. And the guy's like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he actually switches places with Tayo a few times for that reason, goes hanging out in their house.
He's like, what should I do to make sure that no one knows? He's like, well, probably no one's going to talk to you, so it won't matter, says Tayo back. And that's sad, but it turns out to be accurate.
Yep.
He reads voraciously. He fights by turning into weird creatures, like a ongoing joke magical girl character who fights with heavy weaponry we've been seeing gags of throughout.
Yeah. Yep.
Or the great hero parrot man.
Yes.
And they need to stretch it out a bit to really focus on all these characters because we've killed too many golems too quickly. We don't want to get to the end this quickly.
There are two golems that last through multiple fights, him being one of them. The other is a multiplying creature that keeps hiding one of its sources, so it keeps regenerating its numbers.
Yeah. And
yeah, he becomes interested in Shimaki because he likes his fighting against his golems because they're tougher than other things.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of get from that the golems are a bit like the angels in Evangelion in that there's sort of a puzzle to solving them once you get past a certain progression to them. And that's part of what the plot of how the battle with the mage plays out, even as we are getting to know these characters very specifically.
The puzzle of Mymacterion is give him a fight that's strong enough, but he shapeshifts away his damage. You can't tell how injured he is. So that's kind of what's been tricking them. But eventually Shimaki beats him. I realize I don't have to summon one golem at a time. He just overwhelms him with three massive monsters.
Yeah, and he literally gets torn apart. It's really, well, that was basically the time at which basically Shimaki basically had the true apotheosis of his powers, more or less.
Yeah,
it's like it's more that he's being held in one's hand. The last one, he's crumbling because his body no longer can handle it.
Yeah,
but even at this end, he's begging the Triforce, like, "What am I? What is a golem?"
Mm-hmm.
And Shimaki's response is, golems are expressions of the soul. You're artistic. You're amazingly artistic.
Mm-hmm. I kind of originally thought of the golems as angels from Evangelion because I had thought of Mymacterion specifically as a parallel to Kaoru from Evangelion.
That's an interesting thing, but I think there's another Gainax reference you can make that's more direct in this series, and that's Fooly Cooly.
As I believe Mizukami Flout says, that's an influence on him, which even if you didn't already know what the connection this had was.
I mean, Fooly Cooly is another work that is very explicitly about growing up. This one, I think, is a much more clear artistic statement about that idea rather than just a 6-episode OVA about weird monsters popping out of a kid's head.
But it does use the same band.
He uses references to the same band. The Pillows, which amazing Japanese pop punk band. Is that what is the genre? Is it punk?
I think that's the best way to describe it. I never pretend to be really that good at genres of that type.
That sort of Japanese mumble rock thing. It's like The Pillows, like Asian Kung Fu Generation, that kind of rock.
I mean, certain things, like the Biscuit Hammer itself is literally a song reference to The Pillows music.
This Biscuit Hammer is a symbol of despair in the course of the entire story. Towards the end, we get what is revealed is the weapon that will destroy it, which is named after another Pillow song. It is called Blues Drive Monster.
So try to imagine like those shaved ice makers that look like a penguin. And then just take one of those, make it planet size, and give it like a funny pointed pick in the hand.
Yeah, a little ice pick. Like this is the weapon that the princess creates to be the thing that will destroy the Biscuit Hammer.
And it's more than ever. It's like, yeah, a kid made this.
Yeah, like yeah. It's pretty clear that like when you think about how all the animals are just. Do we want to talk about that now or save it a little bit?
I mean, late in the story, like after the epilogue, Yuhi asks Anima in a conversation, like, those don't appear to be any specific zodiac or horoscope. So what did you name it after?
That was just what we came up with as kids.
Yeah, we looked at the moon. We thought we saw things in it. Swordfish, a mantis. Sure.
Yeah. So all the things that they imagined as kids, they became the themes for the animals of this mage war.
Yep. Great. The Blues Drive Monster will be seen by those who look beyond despair.
Yep. Then you have the last Cooly Cooly reference is the name of the final attack the Knights use by joining all their domains. The Shooting Star Wish, or Ride on Shooting Star.
From the song, if you know Cooly Cooly, you know the end song from that.
Mm-hmm. Like that guitar riff from Ride on Shooting Star is just like drilled into my brain. It is one of those quintessentially perfect pieces of music.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure they didn't use Pillow's music in the anime, which is another sin, but
they actually did. They apparently used it as an insert theme at one point. I looked it up.
That's cool.
Oh, really? I'm happy at least that they did that much.
Yeah.
So yeah, then I guess listen, we've talked about so much, and I guess at this point we can continue to just talk about the final conflict and what it all means.
Yeah, let's talk about how everything sort of ties together. The final battle is a very quick fight against the 12th Golem.
Like, he gives them months to fight. He goes, I'm going to give you this many months. And they spend the entire time working on doing a combined attack together.
Yeah.
He teleports Sammy right out of the fight, but...
Yep.
But they blast it with a couple of just huge explosive abilities that just destroy this kaiju-sized menace.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because, like, with all of their preparation, the 12th Golem was actually really easy for them.
Well, it's an all or nothing. You can't fight. Like, yeah. With abilities they have, you're either going to take it out with your super shot or you're going to be a splatter on the ground.
Yeah,
let's be honest.
Though there's an interesting wrinkle in this because there's a strange bending of the rules that Animus mentions. There's a question of, do we even want to defeat the 12th Golem in the normal way? Because apparently... this time around, it was agreed that there was a bending of the rules that if Yuhi specifically dies, the rules are normal. But if the 12th Golem dies and Yuhi is still alive, Animus can activate the Biscuit Hammer immediately. Normally, all 12 knights have to be dead first.
Usually they also have, we're not going to buy your stupid trick.
Yep.
So, but no, the Biscuit Hammer activates and it's coming towards the ground. And then Yuhi is sent to activate Blues Drive Monster. Now, throughout the story, there's been this sort of world of dreams that he goes to while unconscious. Like, he can meet other characters there. They're kind of like they're themselves without any pretense, though that no one remembers it most of the time until he comes there while awake. So he runs through there. He had met the characters that died. He had met Hengetsu. He had met Master there. And he runs through there to activate the Blues Drive Monster.
Mm-hmm.
And it fails.
Yep.
it breaks against the hammer, just splat.
Mm-hmm.
Then, at the very last moment, Samidare seizes the pieces of the Blues Drive Monster with her power and forms them into a replica of herself and uses her punch to destroy the Biscuit Hammer with her fist.
Like we're in Ashura's Wrath early, it just turns into this giant half her and just smashes through it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this pisses off Adam. It's like, it took me forever to make this. Now it's going to take me forever to make the next one. So I'm just going to kill you all now.
There's a really terrifying panel of him saying it's time for the slaughter.
First, he just attacks them, kind of flinging them around. The only reason they're not dead immediately is that Katani's using his healing power, but that's going to destroy his mind because it's a very difficult power to use.
It's actually a really interesting panel, though, that one. I kind of parallel it to like basically the scary mode of Mob in Mob Psycho 100.
Yeah, like basically he becomes fed up. He forms a biscuit hammer his size and he turns into this giant spiky black creature, like human size, but it's like it's indistinct mass of static and black spikes.
It's chilling.
And like they describe, he's like a concentrated ball of malice. Like this is all the angry child wanting to break the game, not being allowed to.
And yeah. I just sort of love the line that like you're the only one who's a child here.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that's Nagumo gets some of that. Okay, he goes to fight. He's keeping Sami away through a massive barrier. So that's another reason that they're not immediately destroyed, because he really is that strong. But
Well, Sami Dare is trying to get through the barrier with her power, and he has to focus a lot of his energy on keeping that barrier because he's actually genuinely afraid of her.
And like in the meantime, the others are trying to fight him, but they can't tell. It's really a huge, crazy fight, and it takes like a last minute shot to really break him.
Nagumo is the one who hits him with the "You're the only one who's a child here."
Well, yeah. He actually gets to ride the horse. That's like one time.
One time.
I'll forget my rule this one time.
Yes. So then Animus is finally destroyed. And
go
ahead.
Yeah. Like he's pinned to the ground by a spear. Let's say he's dying.
Yeah.
He and Anima have sort of this long, long goodbye where he doesn't understand why he couldn't get what he wanted.
And he said it would take him 800 years in his revival to after being reincarnated.
What will your next life be? He's like, I guess I should atone for what I did. I guess it would take 800 years, maybe. I see it. I'd like to be someone who knows everything. So yeah. I took it from a couple of sources that he probably reincarnated in the past to be master.
Yeah, that's my interpretation of it as well.
Yeah, but the one who said he had to tell him, I have a message for him. We are human.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting read, actually. I didn't consider that the first time I read it, but I think it's actually a pretty cool possibility.
It's a very good, subtle Mizukami lines.
Yeah, it is a mystery that's not directly spelled out in the story, but I think it is very clearly what Mizukami intended.
It seems like the sort of thing he'd do from what I know of the style.
Animus is defeated, and it's bonus boss time.
Yeah, Samadari jumps to the top of a nearby pillar, because around this artificial landmass that Animus had created to be dramatic, just floating in the air. It's like, well, I have an announcement to make. I shall now destroy the world.
Yep. And she turns the giant replica of herself in the sky that had just destroyed the biscuit hammer towards the world and starts lining up a punch.
Yeah. It's going slow, like cosmic size, but it's moving and it's pulling back for the blow.
Yeah.
and so the others are like you're joking, right? And immediately I was like, no, they're serious. And then Yugi moves to intercept them all. And Yugi wrecks house.
Oh, yeah. Yuhi takes out every single one of the knights.
Yuhi actually reveals the ultimate form of his power that he had been working on in secret, and something that only he can do.
His technique, Babylon, basically creates a wide field, which enhances all his motions, but also hinders his opponents. But even though they knew about it, he also was holding back how strong it was.
Mm-hmm.
Between that and between the fact he understands he's fighting people that don't want to kill him. Now, he very much just like he immediately knocks out Shimaki because the guy had made a 13th golem, which is a giant cast. Like, if you make a 12th giant cast, a 13th versus something, you make a 14th golem, I probably won't be able to stop you. So he basically gives him a sleeper hold instantly.
Yep.
Mikazuki's down on the ground complaining that this fight looks awesome and he can't join it.
Yeah, because he hurt himself too bad.
He ties up Yayoi by her skirt, like over her head, which just makes her mad.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very mad, but he's still knocked you down.
And so at the very end, after he's defeated all of the knights, Yuhi declares that he stopped all of the other knights because only he is allowed to stop Sami Dare from destroying the world.
Yep.
And funny thing is, and she's like, I thought so. And she's not even angry. She's kind of become this sort of, she's gone through this wistful, far away look. It's like, this is like, I guess this is what I expected.
I kind of like that parallel, though.
Oh, yeah. It's a great parallel. Like, because she can't live in the world, she's going to destroy it. He is the only one who's allowed to save her because of how much he loves her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he tries to reach her as she floats off into the sky while Anima helpfully tells the other knights who didn't know about her story what happens.
Yeah. Well, first, they have an actual fight, though, and Yuhi can't quite overcome the difference in the level of raw power that is between them.
she won't fight him. She actually just kind of goes, gets out of his reach. Like, she knocks him down, but then floats away. It's like, it's been a running thing that he wants to fly, and he wants to fly higher than her. And he's not reaching, but then the other knights create one more unified field to push him up to her.
Something that we kind of missed real quick. I believe it's when they're going off to the fight. There's this repeated shot of every single knight turning their back towards the camera. Or away from the camera.
Looking towards the future.
Yeah, which is a symbol of looking towards the future. We also get this picture of Sami Dare seeing everyone walking away in that exact same form. And so, like, that same idea of her looking, of everyone else looking to the future, is her being unable to catch up to any of them.
Yeah, because basically her whole motivation for this, we find out, was that essentially the future is the only place she cannot go. She is not allowed to exist in the world, and everybody she has come to care about is now going to leave her because she cannot exist anymore.
Like, she literally imagines them all walking away from her while she stands still.
I believe it says Yuhi reaches her. Like, we get to see a shot of Yuhi in that group shot of her image in her mind, turning around to reach out to her.
Turning back around to see her and make sure she's coming.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, as they stand in the, as they, like, float through the air, like, hit with momentum, her flight there, they literally have an argument. It's just saying, like, you can't, I can't go where you are. So, well, then I'll bring you with me.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that symbolism of the characters' backs and then Yuhi turning around to extend his hand. It was, I mean, I was tearing up at that entire panel.
And just, like, it just ends with them just, like, standing together in the air. She just admits that she loves him more than the world.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, Sami Dare is able to find hope, and the world is not going to be destroyed. Then we get an epilogue 10 years later.
After Mikazuki insists on one last fight for no reason.
Yep.
Literally just, like, here's a pair of idiots having a fight.
Yep.
Yeah. It's great.
But yeah, so, like, we literally see a adult Yuhi, who we had seen once before, and when he was in the world of dreams, she's like, so this is the face I saw back then. So, and then Anima appears from him in that world.
Yeah, we kind of realize that world of dreams is actually connecting through all different times and timelines.
I call it's a version of the collective unconsciousness, is why I would say first.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She even admits that she came here to see him at this age. So, like, I wanted to see your face. Like, oh, can you see it? He's laughing at her.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out the flash forward, which is very silly.
Yeah, we learn where everyone ended up, what they're all doing, who's married who, who's going out with who.
Yayoi met Mary Shimaki, which Anima literally can't process. She does a no thoughts, head empty look at it.
Yeah. I mean, they make a cute couple. Yep. It's just it's not something that was, like, developed over the course of the story. It's something that we're, like, explained.
It happened in 10 years.
Yeah, it happened in 10 years.
10 years is a long time. Shit happens.
Most importantly, Sami Dare actually survived her illness after a successful surgery.
By her mother, the amazing doctor.
Yep. Yeah. She's on the road to recovery, and she's ready to live for the future.
And by her words, the road's to do every event to the Olympics all at once.
Yes.
Oh, and Mikazuki might be dating the 17-year-old girl he knew when she was a little kid. So,
is it oriental to say Japan, or is that just, like, Hail to the Genji is a thing that is, like, one of these seminal works of Japanese literature?
I guess I just don't worry about it too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yukimachi is dating Akane, who's taken up wearing Hawaiian shirts and just kind of being a ronin between college.
Yeah. I kind of liked Akane's whole thing, though, because in that basically flash forward that they do a whole thing where Akane's father has finally kind of realized that he's been shitty to Akane most of his life, and basically says, hey, I want you to be okay. Here's a bunch of money that I've saved up for you. You're not obliged to do anything. You can leave. You can stay here. You can do what you want, but I'm sorry. And
I know I've been a shitty dad. And
yeah, like, Akane doesn't forgive him and just says, bye, shitty dad, and takes the money.
I think he's at least play enough not to say it directly to his face.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like saying, like, you know, it makes you go back to, we completely skipped over, Yuhi's grandfather early tries to reconcile. He's like, I've been living with your cousin, and she's really shown me the truth of it. Yuhi screams in his face, and Rudolph's saying, so 10 years with me was nothing, but 1 month, my cousin was enough to open your heart again. Mm, and he still tries to forgive his grandfather. He actually uses his wish to cure his illness, though his grandfather dies randomly later, and it leaves him in a fugue state.
Yeah.
But to me, the idea of what it means to forgive someone, if you should, that hits me really hard sometimes.
Yeah, it's really... I find those kind of themes really poignant, and this series kind of has them in spades.
The question of forgiveness is a tough one. And my general stance is the only person who is actually allowed to give forgiveness is the people that you have wronged. And they are not obligated to give it to you.
I mean, not to go too obvious here, but BoJack Horseman season one's big moment, if you recall.
Oh, yeah.
that's fine. I don't forgive you.
Mm-hmm. I will probably want to do a BoJack Horseman mini log at some point. Maybe even I don't know. That series is another one that I'm like, I want to talk about it at some point. It might be a while before I'm ready to, though.
So at the very near the end of all of this, Anima kind of reveals the bombshell, I guess, that her ancestors were Hangetsu and Professor Asahina, Samidare's sister.
Who were flirting pretty heavily before he died, but that's just one of those story elements we never mentioned. But they describe time as time is never going to be the same thing. It's the whole, it's a divergent timeline for the second anime smashed the world.
Mm-hmm. What's the exact sequence of this last part? Because I think it's really poignant.
Sami comes back from overseas with her sister, says how she's so healthy she's going to take the gold in every Olympic events. They all meet up at a beach where they talk about how Nagumo won the lottery back then. Mm-hmm. Sami made them all dolls of their animals, like ones such as Hanako. She also made a mouse there. Like she made Mikazuki a dog as well as a crow, and she made a little version of Anima for herself, which looks like a weird angel with no legs. But and then they all just things like we're walking the beach, like. So 10 years ago, we were a group of psychics known as the Beast Knights. We fought against a wizard and his golem in order to save the planet. Within our group, there was a secret third party also planned to destroy the planet. This story about the destruction of the planet took about a year. We were part of such an amazing story, and it ended. Yet 10 whole years later, our lives are still continuing. Our story is still continuing with our allies, the people who were left with us. And so, we all grew up a little.
The Seven Seas translation is, and thus we all grew up just a little bit. But in any case, like that overarching end to it is just like the perfect capstone to what this series is trying to say. Growing up is a process that will never stop in your life unless you let it. If you let it, you're probably not going to be able to get any further than you are right now.
I mean, God knows I'm almost 40 and I still know there's things I don't want to grow up about because I know the things I value as them, but other things I need to learn to find more. And so that's still not changing even now.
Yeah, everybody has some growing up to do. I mean, even Nagumo kind of had some growing up to do in his series.
Yeah, now he's a private detective.
Yep.
So, any case, that was a good discussion, and I think we did it in a good amount of time. I think this is about right for a mini-log, so...
Yeah, so no more Gurren Lagann. We describe every event that we love. We just have to accept. We have to grow up and accept it can't be everything.
Yep. We can't have everything. We can only have a few... We can only have a little bit of time. And thus, we all, too, grew up a little bit.
We share a little bit of time, and then life moves on.
Next week, we're going back to Kingdom Hearts, where we'll check in on Aqua in Kingdom Hearts 0.2, Birth by Sleep, A Fragmentary Passage.
Dash, A Fragmentary Passage, dash.
Yes. Okay. This is probably the most absurd name in all of Kingdom Hearts.
So, have you suspected that Aqua might not be having a good time? Let's just prove that and just watch it get worse.
Next week's going to be rough.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, until next time, I'm John.
I'm Jared.
And I'm Matt.
And remember, a good story is best enjoyed with friends. Thank you for listening to Backlog Dialogues. If you're enjoying our deep dives and discussions, be sure to leave a 5-star review on the podcatcher of your choice. If you're really enjoying our deep dives and discussions, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/backlogdialogues. If you'd like to hear more episodes, you can find our archives at backlogdialogues.com. Special thanks to Eli for our theme song. Kingdom Hearts and all associated trademarks are the property of Disney and Square Enix. Please support the official release.
You can sort of tell Akane has a crush on him, on the older guy, so...
Yeah, yeah.
Then the last night is the Owl Night, and it's worth mentioning...
Subaru. You mean Subaru has the crush?
Oh, yes. Mm. Ah, fucking hell. Yeah.
Say that line again, please, so that it's easy to edit.
Ah, fucking hell, that.
No, no.
Oh, you mean...